Hello there, everyone, and good morning. I'm James Bell. I'm head of the Clinical Negligence Department here at Kingsley Napley, and we're based in the City of London and act for clients right across the country. I'm here with Dr. James Jarvie for another episode of KN Talks, and James has kindly agreed to come on and have a chat to us about clinical negligence claims, in particular those relating to general practice and the common issues that feature in these cases. And over to you, James, to introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Yeah, thanks, James. So, as you say, my name is Dr. James Jarvie. I qualified as a GP. I'm just going to try and work out how long ago this was, because it seems like an awful long time ago. So I think it was in 2006. And since then, I've had experience across several areas of general practice and had several roles. So I've been a locum, I've been salaried GP in rural and urban practices. I've worked in out-of-hours settings. I'm now a partner in a rural Devon practice. And I've also done a lot of teaching at the medical school and been involved in appraising GPs as well. I've also been the lead for clinical governance at the practice over the past 5 years. And that's what I guess laid the foundations for a move then into working in medical legal areas and acting as an expert witness.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you've got a great spread of work there, really, which is, I think, essential for anyone who's going to be working as an expert. So I think it's absolutely essential. You've got that wide range of views, and especially the appraisal work and clinical governance work gives you the big overview, which is, I think, really essential. And just moving on to really the nuts and bolts of being a GP, I think the public are very aware of the pressures and so on. And I suppose as a lawyer in this field, I'm very aware of how difficult it is and how maybe sometimes our criticisms might be a bit unfair. You're juggling vast numbers of patients, you've got limited resourcing issues. And I suppose many cases I've seen, you know, we're sometimes saying to a GP that you missed this particular email, or you missed this particular scan result and you didn't send it on to the right person, or you didn't read it. And sometimes we feel, I feel perhaps, that it's a little bit harsh on occasions. I just wonder if you could tell us about how much information you're receiving during the course of a day, how many emails, phone calls, time pressures. And do you think it's unfair to say you've missed this one email, you didn't forward it on, as a result, there's been a catastrophic result for the patient? I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, you know, tiny errors that have really significant consequences.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this before I came on, and I actually thought to myself, you know, how many patient contacts do we have in a single day? And it varies. So some days it's a little bit quieter, some days it's busier. I thought probably on average in a day, I would have 80 contacts. Now, that can be medication queries that don't require speaking to the patient, but require assessing, obviously, their need for the medication, the safety, you know, safety issues in terms of prescribing. It may involve telephone calls, face-to-face appointments and visits. So I worked out with that 80 contacts. I would say I probably have on average an 11-hour day. So I thought that's about 660 minutes. So it's a little over 8 minutes per contact, if I've got that correct in terms of maths.
Yeah.
In addition, I would say on average, probably around 30 scan documents, probably between 30 and 40 blood results and other path results, microbiology and also radiology results. In between that, we've got to kind of get in some kind of driving to visits and some form of fueling ourselves, so eating drinking, and we try and I think practices almost universally try and honor a coffee break at some point in the morning, where they get together and break, but also talk about any issues that have cropped up and popped up through the day. So, yeah, it's in terms of the question of what it's like, it's exhausting. Mm. And things are being done at a very fast pace.
Yeah.
Now, they still, you know, we are trained to do that. That's what yeah. we're paid to do. We're paid to make safe decisions quickly. And yeah, it is very difficult. So yeah, just guide me a bit about the question where you'd like me to go with that, because I'm aware I've given you all the kind of
yeah. No, I think that's really good. I suppose, you know, if you accidentally delete an email while you're flicking through your emails, imagine you accidentally delete an email that contains an abnormal blood test result. Mm. And the, if you like, the hot potato that's being passed around with this patient, it's currently sat with you and the GP doesn't do anything. I mean, I suppose there is no real mercy from the courts in terms of you've deleted that email accidentally and therefore things have not got actioned. I suppose that is just the nature of the job, isn't it? If you make a tiny error, I just wanted to get a sense of how much information was coming in and how much you have to deal with. I know, say, for example, in the aviation industry, they have things like sterile cockpits. You know, when you get to, say, I think it's 10,000 feet, the stewardesses are no longer allowed to come in with cups of tea or coffee, and you're no longer allowed to bother the captain and the crew from 10,000 feet when they're coming into land. They call it sterile cockpit. I'm just wondering, you've got all these distractions and people coming in and emails and texts and probably lots of portals you have to work with and past results. I was just trying to get a sense of how difficult it is and how easy it is just to overlook something, perhaps, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. It is very, very easy to overlook something. And yeah, it's interesting that juggling thing. So on top of this, I was thinking just the other day at work, so I was duty doctor, which means everything comes to me that can't go somewhere else, and that includes knocks on the door and phones ringing. On top of that, I was supervising a paramedic and a trainee GP and some medical students.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, inevitably you've got a few jobs on the go, so things you have to be quite methodical. Yeah. And have a system to make sure you don't just, you know, lose the patient's notes you're in the middle of, or as you say, you know, a blood result, if that is filed as normal and no further action by just a simple kind of absent-minded click, potentially that will just disappear until you know, 2 years later they present with you know, severe renal failure, having missed the early signs 2 years previous. So, and that is one of the cases that I had recently, was a blood test that was reported as normal, and then subsequently follow up wasn't arranged, and their kidney function did deteriorate.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a difficult balance, but as you say, it's not, in the eyes of the courts, it's not a valid reason for making an error. So the responsibility is ours to try and make sure that we do the best we can to manage everything that comes in safely and quickly.
No, that's really helpful. I mean, I don't think there's any answer to this, and certainly the courts, when it comes to solicitors making errors or doctors making errors, there is just no mercy shown. It's, you know, it had to be done, you didn't do it, you've made an error. So I think it's just there is no leeway allowed to a professional, really, when an error happens, a tiny error, and as I say, it can lead to huge consequences. I suppose, just picking up on that, do you see an increase in the amount of complaints or claims, do you think, over your over the last 17 years you've been in practice?
Yeah, definitely. I think the only period where that didn't apply was over COVID, where we didn't have to answer complaints, I think it was a year, maybe a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I think we still endeavoured to answer them, but I think a lot of practices opted not to over that period of time. But actually, over that period of time, I would say it was very unusual to get a complaint. There were almost no complaints. But yeah, over the years, I think with the increased pressures on the NHS, I mean, I qualified in 2006, 2007. At that point, I remember my colleagues, senior colleagues, saying this was kind of the best they can ever remember the NHS in terms of how it was organised, how it was funded. Since then, it's seen a gradual decline until obviously the last couple of years where waiting lists have just you know, exploded.
Yes.
And I think there was a lot in the media. They were creating pressure for face-to-face appointments, where at the same time, GPs were being advised or had recently been advised to manage whatever they can remotely because of COVID, but also an increased drive from up top to, you know, optimize kind of remote consultation and IT, in general practice. And I think, you know, when you've got the media kind of driving that patient dissatisfaction to some extent in terms of, you know, they expect to get what, you know, a timely face-to-face appointment. But on our side, we're having to triage a lot of things to make sure they get appropriate and safe treatment in the, you know, the right time. Yeah. That then creates a bit of a conflict, and I think from that there is a lot of the complaints we see against GPs and the GP practices involve that kind of mismatch of expectation and what we can provide.
That's really interesting. I think about public perception and what constitutes good medical care is that sometimes the patient perception of what that is maybe not quite accurate, because say for example you've got, you know, for example, you've got blood in your urine or whatever, you could send a message on the e-consult to your GP. So I've got blood in my urine. They say, OK, come in, give us a sample. And then that goes off to a laboratory. And you can go through the whole process, get referred onto a hospital. You've never had a face-to-face appointment. But for some, and that's the best possible service you can give and the quickest possible service. And actually putting a face-to-face consultation in that process would slow it down. Public thing, I didn't even see a GP, you know, this is terrible. Actually, they've got a brilliant service without the face-to-face consultation. So I suppose that's what you're battling, isn't it, sometimes?
Absolutely, I mean, we've moved over in our practice to a total triage system. So some come in as phone calls to the receptionist and some come through as e-consults. And I would say probably less than a quarter of those that come, those consultations that are coming in that are being triaged result in a face-to-face appointment. And it's interesting if you look at how many request it at the outset, that, you know, because they are asked, what would you like to get from this?
Yeah,
I'd say probably a majority say that they would like a face-to-face appointment.
But
when we speak to them, it's not really necessary, or when we read through the e-consult and respond. So and I guess it's how we manage that and how we address their kind of their expectations. So in general practice, we're often taught, we're always taught from, you know, from training to explore ideas, concerns, expectations of the patient. And so, you know, if we establish that early on, and when we formulate a management plan that kind of comes round and we acknowledge their expectations and we say why we're doing what we're doing and why it's, you know, maybe not necessary to see them in person, often that means that they're more satisfied with the outcome.
Just sorry to stay on the complaint issue, but also the I suppose not just complaints, it's claims as well. I mean, we often have patients coming to us, claimants coming to us saying I've had a bad service from my general practitioner, I want to bring a claim. And often, you know, the first questions they will have, or you know, will it cost me anything, how long will it take, what's the likely level of damages? And those are the first three questions, probably. The fourth question is, what do I do about my ongoing relationship? You know, I'm there, my wife's there, my two children are all there with this practice. What shall I do? And my advice to them is always, and this is based on genuine experience over the 26 years I've been practicing, is in fact, I think the way this country works is if you complain, you actually receive a better service. Or if you're making a claim, you might receive a better service. Often that's frequently what I do see. Mm. But patients often think, if I'm bringing a claim, I'm going to get a much worse service. I'm going to be ignored, or my treatment's going to be affected, or my wife's treatment will be affected. There'll be a black mark against me in the practice. So that's people's concerns, which we do try and allay. I mean, sometimes the problem is so serious that there is a breakdown of trust and confidence, and they have to move on. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that. I mean, it must be very difficult for not you or your colleagues, but if you hear about friends or colleagues who having to treat people with an ongoing claim, presumably you have to pass those over to a colleague to see them in most situations. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so I mean, we operate a list system at our practice, and there's good evidence that a list system is better for patient outcomes. It reduces complaints. It builds a relationship, a personal relationship. And yes, if there are complaints, initially, in terms of complaints, when there are complaints, that can make the relationship a bit wobbly for a while, but it's usually quite easy to recover. I think when it escalates to potential legal action, like you say, generally when that is in progress and before it's resolved, it's likely that they would probably move in our practice to a different list, to someone else's list. Yeah. Now, there will be no reduction in their service at all. It's likely that the new GP will know what's going on. Like you say, people who do complain and kind of make a bit of a noise or protest about what's happened or what's happening to them, it does make us probably the other way and probably more likely to give a good service.
Yes.
Because you know, we feel bad about it. I think the GP who is involved originally will be feeling bad, and the GP who ultimately takes over their care will want to make sure they feel positive about the service they receive.
I think just sort of sticking with that sort of idea about the trauma, both for the patients who've had a bad outcome, and also obviously recognizing the trauma that legal action takes on professionals in doctors facing such claims. I think we as a profession, the medico-legal profession, both doctors, experts and lawyers, have to recognize it's traumatic on both sides. Lawyers for the defendants obviously recognize this because they're dealing face to face with people accused of wrongdoing, and there is I think obviously a change recently where we've gone from the MDU and MPS, so that's Medical Defence Union and Medical Protection Society, acting for GPs in negligence claims. Now, just to explain to the audience, they were private membership organisations, very similar to insurance companies. And those organisations represented general practitioners when they were being faced with claims. Now, what happened in 2019 is those claims were moved, and they're now being dealt with by NHS Resolution. So that's the main insurer body, as it were, for the National Health Service. NHS Resolution is like an in-house claims handler that deals with all claims and most of the time settles claims without needing to go to trial or being passed over to external law firms. Just on that point, Dr. Jarvi, have you noticed any difference between cases being dealt with by NHSR and MDU and MPS? I mean, either as an expert or in your own practice?
So as an expert, it's always been NHS Resolutions that have been dealing with any defence. It's interesting, in our own practice, probably the biggest difference we noticed was almost, well, literally overnight, we went from paying thousands, it was going up every year, 10,000 plus every year to just practice, to then that being taken on by the NHS. I think there was a lot of relief from clinicians, because I think they felt there was quite a severe tax on working, you know, longer hours or additional sessions or in out of hours. Working in the out of hours settings. So I think it made it easier for people to work more and more flexibly. But actually, I think, I think they manage it very well, the NHS resolutions. I think, like you said, they're always looking to settle things without the need to go to court. And I think there's probably, I mean, you can probably tell me this, whether there is less, whether there are fewer cases going to court as a result of the change.
Yeah, I think the statistics are, this is sort of in the post-COVID era, I think the statistics are there is less claims being issued, certainly, and more settling. I mean, I've certainly got experience myself personally of going to trial against a general practitioner who was represented by the Medical Defence Organisation. And we got to trial, this did for a 4-day trial. And the general practitioner was very young. He'd been qualified, I think, at the time of the negligence, he'd been qualified for about 3 months. And we had really strong GP expert evidence. We had really strong orthopaedic evidence on causation. And we got to trial with a very experienced barrister acting for us. And actually I actually felt quite sorry for the general practitioner himself, who was, you know, the case was being defended very hard by MDO. And of course he was required to go into the witness box and give evidence in the High Court. And he, I think I'm not naming any names here, but he was not able to give a very good account of himself here. And looking back, I do query, exactly why the case was defended, because on the end of day three of a 4-day trial, the case was conceded and they said, we're not fighting this any further. And I thought, this is actually really unfortunate what you've done here for the general practitioner, because he's been exposed to really brutal, frankly, cross-examination in public. And I, you know, in retrospect, the case should not have been defended. No. And I'm saying that I'm biased. I'm a claimant lawyer. And I just feel that would be quite a brutalizing experience for that general practitioner. And maybe that wouldn't have happened. I'm very sure that case wouldn't have gone to trial with the NHS resolution.
And I think that's a really positive change, because actually, you know, if doing this work, the medical legal work, has taught me that actually, you know, it's not something that GPs should ideally take personally. You know, we spoke earlier about the volume of work coming in. Inevitably, everybody is going to make mistakes in that environment. But you know, human beings make mistakes anyway. You know, it's not a reflection of being a bad doctor. It's not a reflection of someone being a bad person. It's unlucky. It's unfortunate for everyone involved, obviously primarily the patient, but also the GP. You know, they have been unlucky, and they will reflect. You know, I know that any colleague who makes a mistake is likely to reflect for long and hard, you know, about that mistake and what they could have done differently. And that will be amplified if it gets escalated to, you know, legal action. But it's easier to move on if things are resolved fairly and quickly and without that traumatizing experience that you describe, which sounds horrendous for the poor GP. And I hope he stayed in the profession, because that's the other worry.
Yes.
And if he didn't, I'm sure he would have done if it had been resolved, you know, in a more kind of sensible way.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I can't forget the trauma, obviously, of my client as well. He had to give evidence in the witness box. And it was just a very poor way of resolving an issue. The claim was £50,000. It wasn't life-changing amounts of money. So in retrospect, you know, a sensible system would not really allow that to happen. And mm. and senior people would have looked at that at an earlier stage and stopped it from going to trial. But I think that's where NHSR is quite good. I mean, I think sometimes they are criticised for being quite slow, running everything by committee, but committees probably generate better outcomes in terms of litigation than an individual making an individual decision saying, we're taking this one to trial. Mm. So I think, you know, like I say, I think hopefully it's a positive that NHSR have now stepped in and are acting for GPs. I think it's a positive thing. I think, you know, I have seen case reports where this is in Lawtel, Westlaw, and I've been reading through the judgment, and it gets to the point where it's talking about the GP, and it's actually said so-and-so was a GP in Cornwall for 20 something years, whatever. As a result of this legal action, she has now retired from practice. And that's, you know, that's really sad to see that actually, like you say, some people are so traumatized by the legal experience, whether it's claimants or defendants, general practitioners or doctors in hospital settings, that the whole process is so traumatizing that the defendant leaves practice altogether for a mistake, not a deliberate issue, you know, not not fabricating records, you know, just for making an error. You know, that's so. And you just think, well, the legal system needs to be better. Well, it makes it less traumatizing for claimants and for defendants, and we get quicker results for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we need to keep hold of as many GPs as we can. And obviously there are the odd ones that, you know, maybe the GMC will view as reason to be struck off or have certain limitations on their license. Mm-hmm. But the vast, vast majority of people who are involved in you know, legal action, the vast majority of GPs are, you know, they are decent GPs, and I'm pleased that NHS Resolution are making an effort to look after them by reaching these sensible conclusions and making the effort. Like you say, it might be more effort, but it's worth the effort to protect patients and clinicians.
Moving on to a completely different supplement for you, I suppose, to talk about unusual things that maybe hospital doctors, specialists, see a lot, but when it comes to general practitioners, they don't see them so much. So maybe things like corticoequine syndrome or subarachnoid hemorrhage, obviously these are bread and butter things for neuroradiologists, neurosurgeons, or for spinal surgeons. But I suppose we always see in the statistics when we talk about these cases, you know, a GP would only see one of these perhaps once every 5 years or once every 10 years. Again, that's no defense for the general practitioner who gets it wrong. But I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that. You know, you've got these incredibly rare conditions, and I suppose as a GP expert, you have to sort of take a step back and say, well, was there enough red flags there to say you had to refer this? You know, I suppose that's just wondering what your thoughts are on those sorts of things that crop up.
Yeah, so I think the key is, as you say, red flags. And there's two things. One is, there's a few things. So firstly, you have to be, you know, we have to be as GPs aware of the latest guidelines that list red flags. And every time we communicate with that patient about, for example, back pain or sciatica, we have to go through that list of red flags. And we have to have a low threshold for referring if we do identify any red flags. So one of my colleagues once said to me a good few years ago now, I was seeing some changing kind of clinical subject. I was seeing someone with chest pain. Now, I knew their chest pain wasn't cardiac, but there were certain, you know, I had a very strong feeling. My gut feeling was that this is not cardiac chest pain. And so I had a chat with him about it, and he said, well, why are you taking the risk? Why are you holding that risk and that worry by admitting them? You're, as GPs, one of our roles is gatekeeper. You know, so we are juggling conflicting roles. We're an advocate for the patient, but we're also gatekeeper of the service. However, there are some things where, you know, it's just not worth holding that risk and limiting access through the gate. And this was one of them. And I just thought, actually, you know what, you're right. I'm just going to send him to hospital and get the blood test, the troponin blood test that he needs to rule out any damage to the heart muscle. And if that's normal, you know, that's great. And but I don't have to go home and then worry about it, or even worse, go home and not worry about it and then find out several weeks later that I've missed you know, that I've missed a myocardial infarction. So yeah, the same with anything involving sciatica and potential caudal equina. It's knowledge of the latest guidelines, it's looking things up frequently and not relying on knowledge that you've had your whole career, because things are constantly changing.
Yes, that's true.
Asking all the red flags. It's also then safety netting. And safety netting is so key to what we do, because we manage a lot of risk in general practice. So it's then educating the patient about what red flags to look for themselves and what to do if they develop. And even better, if people can, if clinicians can then send the patient some kind of written information, some resource where they have a list of those red flags and instructions of what to do if they develop, we're keeping patients safe, and we're keeping ourselves as GPs safe from potential litigation as well.
I think, and putting it in writing, I think it's absolutely essential and absolutely best practice. And you know, there's so many studies on how much information people actually take in during a conversation. You know, I've actually had people who've come to me who want to bring a claim saying, I was told I had cancer. It turned out I didn't have cancer. And they've actually been in a consultation with a doctor where he said, there's something on your back, there's a growth on your back, and it's not cancer. And unbelievably, they've actually screened out the words, it's not cancer, and just heard the word cancer. And walked out of that consultation thinking, I've got cancer. So I suppose it's putting, and obviously that case got quickly resolved, because you know, it was a complaint where the doctor said, I'm really sorry here, you've got completely wrong end of the stick here. And it was all over very quickly, of course. But I think, you know, putting things in writing for people is a great way forward. And hopefully there's some technology that can help general practitioners to cut down those misunderstandings, I suppose, really.
Yeah. So a new development in the last few years, we've been able to text patients very easily. We never used to be able to do that. We were able to email patients. The text messages, we can put, we can click something that generates a link so that they can click the link to respond.
So there's a
lot of technology that we can use. You know, we don't have to print things off, which is good. But obviously environmentally we want to reduce the amount of paper that we're using, but also there's a very reliable audit trail when you've sent something by text or email, which is always helpful.
That's great. So but if it does come to litigation, of course, then it's all documented what was said. And that's probably a good time. I think you've got some questions for me about clinical consent issues, really, which perhaps we'd sort of have a look at now if you're happy.
So this arose from a case recently, and it was about, now what was it about? It was about carpal tunnel syndrome and injections. There was one of the accusations was that the patient was not consented fully and was not appraised of all the potential risks and complications of the injection. Now they ended up having a complication which on balance was probably due to the injection and was a recognized complication. But the accusation was they were not consented sufficiently for it. Now, when I was completing this report, I thought, well, okay, there's good evidence, or there's not any evidence that they were consented particularly well. You know, it wasn't listed the complications that the patient had been advised about. But I found myself thinking, well, I've never had a patient refuse a carpal tunnel injection. And yet, you know, I've tried to be as thorough as possible with consent. So actually, on balance, that injection would have happened anyway, and therefore the complication on balance would have happened anyway. So my question was, you know, how the courts view that, because I don't think I've had that come up in this way. And I wonder what your thoughts were around that.
Consent is a huge subject, and it's never ending. Obviously, we've got the Montgomery judgment, which came out a few years back, which sort of set the standard for a few years. That case has been slightly modified a little bit recently by another Scottish case. But the general rule really is that if a patient is going to say, I wasn't warned of that, I mean, first of all, that's a factual question, and that's going to be for the general practitioner to say, well, I did say that orally, or I wrote it down and they signed a piece of paper, they've signed a consent form. That's a kind of factual question. If a patient is going to say, I wasn't warned of it, they've got to prove that, first of all. And then secondly, they have to say, and if I had been warned of it, I would have done X, Y, Z. And now that has to go into the claimant's witness statement. The claimant, it can't just be a one-line response. The claimant has to say, I wouldn't have gone ahead with that procedure, and the reasons I wouldn't have gone ahead with it are because ABC. And that's got to be, as far as the courts are concerned, that's going to be quite convincing evidence. And to sort of look into that further, you might want to say to the patient, well, have you ever refused an operation before? Have you ever had a similar injection before and you've refused that, or have you always gone ahead with them? And also, the courts will go to statistics. So just as you've said, I mean, you've said that anecdotally, I've never had anyone refuse. The courts would say to the experts concerned, go away, find the statistics on this, find out how many patients refuse carpal tunnel syndrome when they're given gold standard consent advice. Mm-hmm. And that's what the court's starting point is. So the claimants have quite a difficult situation with straightforward, ordinary issues like maybe a carpal tunnel injection. I suppose where the courts have more sympathy is when it's a really massive complication. So it's spinal surgery, risky spinal surgery, and a 10% chance of paralysis. There the courts are going to say, well, there was a huge chance here, and they'll be more sympathetic to the claimant saying, look, had I been told that, I wouldn't have gone ahead. I would have had physio for another 2 years, or I would have done Pilates or whatever. I would have found ways to just try and keep going. I wouldn't have gone ahead with that surgery. And the courts would have a lot more sympathy there. Generally speaking, it's if you've just got a consent case and nothing else, there's no technical error in the procedure. These are not easy cases for claimants to prove on the whole. But as I say, you'll get cases where defendants have been really sloppy with their consenting process. And what generally might happen, as I say, maybe it's a spinal surgery setting. The consultant has jumped straight from A to F. And they said, right, F is big spinal surgery with lots of metal work. They haven't said you could have, there's other treatments out there. There's radio frequency treatment. There's physio. There's medication. They haven't gone through all that. They've just jumped from A to F, and that's maybe a very clear cut from a claimant perspective. We'll say, look, that is, we're pretty much saying that's bang to rights on our side of the fence, and we've got experts who would say that's just not acceptable. It's very different when it's in that sort of GP setting, if it's minor surgery. And there've been lots of interesting cases. So there was an interesting case actually down in, Jones against Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital was a case where a lady was actually promised a particular surgeon to do her surgery. And she really wanted that surgeon to do it. And on the day of the surgery, she was told, well, he's not available. I'm going to do it instead. And there was a big factual dispute. The surgeon who actually did the surgery said, I told the patient I was doing it. And the patient was adamant and said, no, you didn't say that to me. And actually, rather surprisingly, the courts went with the patient's factual evidence and said, no, we don't think you were warned. We don't think you were told that this junior surgeon, much more, sorry, not junior, but a much younger, less experienced surgeon was going to be doing it. And the claimant actually won on that case. And that's quite unusual because generally speaking, you know, the the professional on the whole is likely to be accepted more than the claimant. And obviously there's this huge thing called hindsight bias. Obviously, if an adverse outcome happens to you, then it's inevitable you're going to say, well, had I been told of that, I wouldn't have had the operation. So the courts are very aware of hindsight bias, where the patient is now saying, no, I wouldn't have done it. And the courts, so the courts are quite reluctant to accept evidence from a claimant who says, no, had I been told of that, I wouldn't have gone ahead. So it's these are very difficult cases for claimants to win on the whole, but some, you know, many do, but it's got to be certain specific facts really that enable the claimant to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because I mean, like I say, it was something that I had kind of got stuck on because I was just thinking, on balance, this would have gone ahead anyway. Yeah. So the fact they have to have had with the lesser, the complications of lower severity, like you say, they have to demonstrate some kind of history of similar behaviour. But obviously with the more severe stuff, it's more believable that someone will be very reluctant to go ahead with a procedure if there's a high chance of death or injury.
I think as an expert witness, I think you've got to be careful to stay away from the factual dispute and say it's completely a matter for the court to decide what the patient would have done. So what we are very happy to see from our experts is to say, if the court accepts the patient's version of events, then the surgery would not have taken place. If the court accepts the general practitioner or the surgeon's version of events, then the consenting process was completely normal, and it's a matter for the court to decide whether the surgery would have gone ahead or not. So I think that's where, as an expert, you need to take a step back and to say, it's not for me to decide what would have happened. For the court to decide. I'm just telling you whether the consent process was good or bad.
Just follows.
And I suppose you could also and then if your instructing party asks you for more information about statistics, then you can dig those out as well. I think it's judges are very protective of their role as deciders of the facts. So I think that's the only thing you think you need to bear in mind as an expert is that they you're not expected to make calls on that whether things would have happened or not. You just set out the scenarios and it really.
The other thing you mentioned that was cropping up a few times there when you were talking was note keeping and keeping records. And that is just the most I mean, obviously what a clinician does is the most important thing, but closely behind that is what the clinician will write in the notes. And it just makes a huge difference. And it's a lot easier to be clear about what has happened if clinicians make good, clear notes. They can be concise, but they need to be thorough as well. So with the safety netting, describe, listing the complications that they have discussed. It just makes it so much easier. I mean, I had a case recently with a remote hospital where, people there seemed to be a culture of not making any notes, which seems to be, a minor injuries unit, let's say. We GPs often will get involved in the running of those. And it is a bit more difficult with handwritten notes and remembering to kind of make an entry, etc. And it takes a bit longer and you have to think about your handwriting and what people can read. But, it just invites so much speculation. And it is very difficult to be certain about facts of any case when the notes are not sufficient to describe accurately what happened and give that impression to someone else reading the notes.
I mean, that's a really interesting and huge subject, and I think maybe that's going to improve with the introduction of technology. I know, for example, when we're requesting and receiving records from, for example, University College London Hospital now, Nothing's handwritten, everything is computerized. So we ask for the records now for a claim, and we receive a 1,000 page or so PDF. And it's just containing all typed records. There's actually nothing handwritten whatsoever. I mean, it probably is a bit of a pain for people who have problems with typing, and maybe the notes are slightly shorter because you may be recording less information, but you're recording the crucial information. You've obviously got boxes to type into, just type in free text. A lot of the information is just obviously clicking buttons and so on, but you do have spaces to do. I've done a ward round. This is what we did.
Yeah.
And that's all recorded, and it's probably being recorded at the exact time that they're doing it. So it's highly contemporaneous as well. So as lawyers, we want to see, and on both sides, on the claimant side, on the defendant side, and the courts, we'd love to see contemporaneous typed records. It cuts down the areas for dispute, really, about is that two ticks for back pain or one tick, or how severe was the back pain. And we do find ourselves talking about that box ticked off the operation. Does that mean severe back pain or moderate back pain? Or, and that makes a difference between us saying, yeah, that definitely shows the nerve was damaged in the operation, or no, it was damaged 2 days later. Whatever. So yeah, record keeping is it cuts down time for the lawyers, really. And it makes it easier for the courts to come to a decision. It makes it easier for the lawyers to decide, well, should this case go to trial or should it just settle, because it's a clear cut case. So,
and going back to red flags. So, you know, often you'll see, often I see in records, I'm doing a report and it just says no red flags. Of course, that's helpful to an extent, but that doesn't tell me if that person is aware of all the red flags. So
it's
far more useful to just specify exactly what red flags have been eliminated.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, I know that none have been left out.
Very, very good point. Yeah. It's not there. Sorry to quote Donald Rumsfeld, it's not the known knowns, it's the unknown unknowns. It's knowing what you, well, knowing that you don't know things is the question. That was really excellent. And thank you so much, Dr. James Jarvie, for coming in to speak to us today. And really fascinating talk about medical ethics, general practice, acting as a practitioner and as an expert as well. But thank you so much for coming in and your sharing your insights with us.
No, not at all. Thank you, James. Thank you. Goodbye.
Okay, cheerio. Bye-bye.